With a woman of kind, smoked my stuff and drank all my wine. Made up my mind, make a new start. Going to California with an ache in my heart. Someone told me there's a girl out there with love in her eyes and flowers. Chances on a big jet plane. Never let them tell you that we're all the same. The sea was red and the sky was gray. I wondered how tomorrow could ever follow today. Hills and the canyons be dimmed and shake. Children of the sun begin to wave. Oh dear. It seems that the wrath of the gods got a punch on the nose and it's starting to flow. I think I might be sinking. Throw me a line if I reach it in time. I'll meet you up there where the paths run straight and high. Without a king, they say she plays guitar and cries and sings.
Not a white mare in the footsteps of dawn. Trying to find a woman who's never, never, never been born. Standing on a hill in the mountain of dreams, telling myself it's not as hard, hard, hard as it seems. It's hard.
Performing live at the BBC's Paris Theatre in London in 1971. That was Led Zeppelin, that last track being Going to California. But for the live music hour, you'll find full track listings via the Chris Hawkins page of the Six Music website at bbc.co.uk/sixmusic. And don't forget, you can listen again for the next 7 days. Next, we head back to 1974 and a BBC session by Blodwyn Pig. After this.
Sunday afternoons from 1.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Hubie Morgan, and this is my collection of musical delights.
Okay.
I try to play all different types of stuff. It gets you moving, gets you grooving, gets you out your seat. Or you can do some seat dancing if you want. Oh, shake it, shake it, shake it, baby.
This is Hubie Morgan.
It kind of goes back to what Louis Armstrong famously said. The two types of music, good music and bad music. And I try to play the good stuff.
Hubie Morgan.
And this weekend, I'm very excited to welcome Ronnie Wood to my show. Unbelievable.
Sunday afternoon from 1 on BBC Radio
6. Music.
Quite a lot of people get up earlier than I do, and I used to be one of them. In fact, it's quite true, really. Because some time ago, I used to drive a lorry, which was quite enjoyable. You never know, I might still. It's a little song I wrote about. It's called The Blues of a Dunstable Truck Driving Man. It goes like this. If I don't earn no money, my woman gonna lay me down. Singing bip 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 boo, bip 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 boo 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 boo. Put me down. Cause if I don't earn no money, Lord, she gonna put me down. Oh yeah. Beep, 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 boo.
stumble over those things that I said before me. Wanna see my way. Watching my life, I can see it's been so long. Climbing mountains without even looking.
Way. You need a friend to help me through Email Chris Hawkins, chris.hawkins@bbc.co.uk.
Thank you.
This is the Live News Gap on BBC Radio 6 Music. Every morning, 7 days a week, from 4 until 5, an hour of live music from the BBC archives for you. And if there's an act you'd like us to dig out for, then please do let me know what it is. chris.6music@bbc.co.uk. Remember, the Live News Gap is a half-hour concert recording followed by a pair of BBC sessions. So get thinking and then drop me a line. So far this morning, Led Zeppelin and Blodwind Pig. And next, it's back to 1994. With Flinch in just one moment.
Music. What makes a story? For me, honestly, a good beginning. There was a time in the forest when things weren't quite as they should have been. A good middle. The waves were as big as mountains. The boy was delighted, but the penguin said nothing. And a good end. And the boy and his friend rode home together, talking of marvellous things all the way. And what makes a writer? Join me, Oliver Jeffers, as I put down the pen and paintbrush and play the music that makes me who I am. From Elvis Presley to Elvis Perkins.
Paperback Writers with Oliver Jeffers.
Sunday from midday on BBC Radio 6 Music.
We'll be right back.
That's I Hope from October 1994. You're listening to the Live Music Hour on Six Music at a band called Flinch. Now, if you'd like random Thursdays 5:15 request, then please do email. Do bear in mind, it's Random Thursday, and I would especially love to hear from you this morning. If you've never been in touch before, if you've never felt the urge in times gone by, then this morning perhaps you'll make that change and break your 5:15 duck. Dead simple. All you need to do is email, text or tweet with a tune of your choice. Any song at all. If we can find it for you, we could be playing your song at 5:15. Email chris.sixmusic@bbc.co.uk. Text 64046. Don't forget, if you are texting, don't forget to put your name and where you're texting from on your message and your choice of tune. You can tweet to @BBC Chris Hawkins. Now, to conclude this morning's live app, here's a last track by Flinch. This from 1994 is a track called Ashtray.
Your voice. Latin's music.
Today from 10, Lauren Laverne.
From 7,
Sean Keaveney. Right now, Chris Hawkins.
Let's talk about my shoes.
Start from the question, why did Putin start the war? And that's probably the most urgent question that many people are asking right now and don't find actually a very good answer to it. And many people say that they continue, that basically they repeat Putin, something about NATO, or security threats to Russia, and so on and so forth, as if the security of Putin's regime is just the same as the national security of the Russian society. And on the other hand, many people seriously think that Putin is just mad. He's an ideological zealot, fanatic, bigot, and he just hates Ukrainians. And so that's the whole war is about just some pure fantasy capturing his mind and throwing the whole country and actually like almost the whole world into some kind of like disaster that we are experiencing now and also experience in Germany. I actually believe that what Putin does is in the rational collective interests of the Russian ruling class. He protects what the Russian ruling class needs in the long-standing class conflict in the post-Soviet societies. It's actually much more than about Russia and Ukraine. It's about the whole region. But in order to understand why is it is so, or at least why I believe it is so, it requires quite a long lecture on what was happening in the whole post-Soviet space and why it has actually been a permanent crisis, and why this crisis led to the culmination in the full-scale war that is going on now in Ukraine, and why this war could actually be the end of this crisis. So, and why Gramsci is actually very much relevant about it, to this, of course. So I'm going to speak about what is post-Soviet condition. I'm going to speak also about how most people who try to apply Gramsci to the post-Soviet societies, they try to approach the problems with the concept of passive revolutions, which I believe is completely misleading in our countries. And what is better to understand the post-Soviet societies is actually another Gramscian concept, hegemony crisis. And what we've seen in the post-Soviet societies have been two deficient solutions to the hegemony crisis, which were not able to solve the crisis. They were either simply conserving the crisis, Caesarist solution, or reproducing and intensifying the crisis via the deficient so-called Maidan revolutions. And understanding this vicious circle of Caesarism and Maidan revolutions, of two deficient solutions, we could understand better the class conflict which stands behind the war in Ukraine and why it could be an end to the very long-standing and very deep crisis of the post-Soviet conditions, the crisis of hegemony. So, post-Soviet condition. In the 90s, when the Soviet Union collapsed, many people believed that would be a road to democracy, that Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, even Central Asia, Caucasian countries, they would follow the road of the Central Europe. They would be democratizing like Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, as they were actually democratizing, liberalizing in 1990s. Then 2010 years came, and that sounded like very much a fairy tale, because it was not like kind of like democratic convergence with the Central Europe. It started to look like Orbán's Hungary and Kaczynski's Poland were moving towards Putin's Russia and Lukashenko's Belarus. So it was looking like not a democratic consolidation, but an authoritarian consolidation. And in this perspective, Ukraine was just kind of like about a weaker authoritarian regime where no candidate to strong authoritarian rule, no Ukrainian president was capable to consolidate the power and to build a kind of like a Putinist regime, but in Ukraine. So other people started to say that just let's say goodbye to the post-Soviet concept. All those countries between, on the one hand, Baltic states, which are EU member states, let's put the most extreme case, Estonia, which believes itself to be a kind of like almost a Nordic country now. And on the other hand, let's say Tajikistan in Central Asia, they just became too divergent. And there is no even sense to speak about any post-Soviet commonality between them. So farewell to the post-Soviet concept. Another response to this could be that actually the very fact that we cannot define in any positive terms what is post-Soviet, besides saying that this is something that followed the Soviet, is actually an answer to the question. Post-Soviet has been a continuous permanent crisis when nothing new replaced the old dying Soviet structures. And that already sounds very, very much Gramscian. The moment when the old has died, but the new has not have born. Many people, however, who tried to speak about Gramsci in post-Soviet context, they were speaking about a passive revolution. Like Gramsci, I know probably there have been already many discussions about the passive revolution. That's a central concept for Gramsci. And originally, he talked about why Italy was not able to follow the route of the French Revolution, a revolution under strong bourgeois hegemony. Why Italy was united by the Piemontese kingdom from above, but the initiatives of Mazzini, Garibaldi failed. And so the passive revolution concept existed in relation to the Jacobin revolution. Italy didn't have a proper Jacobin revolution and the bourgeois hegemony. So it had to modernize, it had to build a bourgeois order, it had to build the modern nation state from above via different route. And unfortunately, that original use has been kind of like forgotten. And that's also partially Gramscian fault when he started to discuss fascism as a passive revolution, American Fordism as a passive revolution. And there were some arguments behind this because it could look like as some other modernizing changes made by the ruling class under the new conditions, but under the conditions of the threat from a Bolshevik, from the Russian Revolution. And that's why New Deal in the United States, and that's why transformation of the Italian state by fascists. But since then, the people talked about neoliberal passive revolution, some decolonization passive revolution, the Mexican Revolution as a passive revolution, and of course in the context of the Soviet and post-Soviet societies, Stalinist passive revolution, Gorbachev passive revolution, Putin's passive revolution, and you now feel that this concept becomes like just too inflated. You can basically interpret every changes that are beneficial to the capitalism, but which are not done under the revolutionary bourgeois hegemony as a passive revolution and make some sense. And of course, Gramscian very quite obscure writings are very much easy to exploit in this direction. So if you want to make any use, any actual use to understand, to explain, and to change the world, we need stricter concepts. And if you stick to the original use in Gramsci, the passive revolution will be conservative modernization by or in compromise with the old ruling class that incorporates some of the grievances of the subaltern classes in the context, and this is crucial, of a threat of a Jacobin social revolution and in order to prevent one. So the Italian ruling class in the 19th century, they were feeling the threat of the Jacobin Revolution that happened in France and was actually very much of a threat in the whole Europe during the 19th century. 1848 was about that, of course. But they were capable to push forward the objectively progressive changes but from the above, without challenging the rule of the old ruling class. So now if you look at the Soviet and post-Soviet conditions, we would see some superficial similarities with this, and well, that's why many people are speaking about post-Soviet passive revolution. So of course the Soviet elite, so-called nomenklatura, the top of the Communist Party, they were playing a very important agency in the capitalist transformation of the former Soviet Union. They were, in the process, they were turning themselves and helping to turn other people into the new capitalists. But this was a very specific kind of capitalist whose income fundamentally depended on the relations to the state. They were political capitalists. They could exploit connections to the political offices, to the specific people, to the specific parties in order to make themselves rich. And on the other hand, the oppositional intelligentsia in the Soviet Union were very much like those Italian Jacobins about whom Gramsci actually wrote very despisingly. He despised them. So he saw that those Italian Jacobins were trying to use the experience of France without any serious application to the difference of the Italian context. And that's why they were failing. And we could see very many similarities with how the Soviet oppositional intelligentsia, the dissidents, and then the post-Soviet professional middle class, so this vibrant civil society, is caught into this illusion that we need to join proper capitalism, not like our bad Soviet capitalism with oligarchs, with Putins, and so on and so forth, but the proper capitalism of the EU, of the United States, and actually join the so-called civilized world, join the elite. And if you are in this very clearly elitist project, that helps to understand why they are remaining not so much popular and why they were failing to form a proper hegemony in the post-Soviet countries. But there are fundamental differences, and that's important to understand the basis of the crisis, and it's also important to understand why passive revolution is quite a misleading concept, to understand what happens. Post-Soviet transformation have never been modernization. We were not transforming into a more progressive social order, state institutions, economic institutions. This was primarily about demodernization, about so-called involution, not evolution, but involution, peripherization of our economies from the economies that were capable to lead in the space race, that were capable to lead in actually in many social achievements of the Soviet age, and that's why the Soviet Union, until some moment, 70s, 80s, was actually presenting a progressive alternative to many third world countries. And many revolutionary movements where they were actually trying to copy the Soviet experience. And there was a reason for that. The post-Soviet transformation was very much rejection of everything that happened, and not in favor of anything more progressive. Fundamentally, the second difference, there was no actual a threat of a Jacobin, neo-Jacobin, of any social revolution. We are now actually living in the world where we do not have social revolutions anymore. We do have many revolutions, but they do not challenge the ruling classes. And I'll be speaking about that a little bit later, about the so-called Maidan revolutions. And this is the problem that actually many sociologists, many social scientists and on the left, on the mainstream, they raise this question. Where did the social revolutions go? Why we have some kind of revolutionary change of the government in many cases every year, but nothing is changing. And if you do not have a threat from a Jacobin revolution, we cannot have a passive revolution. There is just no need to push for some progressive changes from above. And some people just are confused about the things like return of the Soviet anthem by Putin that he made in 2000s, or some restoration of the social benefits. But this is a typical Caesarist balancing. There is nothing actually progressive in just making the old Soviet institutions work. And finally, those intellectuals, quasi-Jacobin, post-Soviet Jacobins, they were not actually allied with the plebeian masses, like in the 19th century Italy. They were opposed to them. They were despising them. They saw them as some backward Soviet rigid people who just vote for Putin and who are actually a part of the problem why we cannot join the proper capitalism of the civilized world. And so that's why there was no anything like transformismo, the individual take of the leaders of the subaltern classes and integration them into the elite. For the
yeah. Go to sleep, you little babe.
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 Your mama's gone away and your daddy's gonna stay. Don't leave nobody but the baby. Go to sleep, you little babe.
Go to sleep, you little babe.
Go to sleep, you little babe.
Go to sleep.
Everybody's gone in the cotton and the corn. Didn't leave nobody but the baby. Your sweet little baby.
Your sweet little baby.
Your sweet little baby.
Your sweet little baby.
Honey and the rock and the sugar don't stop. Gonna bring a bottle to the baby. Don't you weep, pretty babe.
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 She's long gone with a red shoe.